If you have a child with a severe food allergy, you worry when you're not with them. Whether your child is going to a sleepover or summer camp, you know how critical it is to be prepared for an allergic emergency. AviQ is the first and only voice-guided epinephrine auto-injector that tells you or a caregiver how to use it. So even when your guidance isn't available, AviQ's guidance can be. It's the voice mamas everywhere can trust as much as their own. Learn more at avi-q.com/motherly. That's avi-q.com/motherly. After using AviQ epinephrine injection, USP, seek emergency medical care. Visit aviq.com for full prescribing and patient information. One of the really fun things about being a parent is hearing profound questions from our kids. In a lot of ways, kids serve as this inspiring reminder of what this life here is all about. And I think there's a reason that in wisdom traditions and cultures and spiritual texts that we talk about seeing through the eyes of children, because they see with a wonder and an honesty that, again, we as adults often we've become too jaded or we're willing to overlook things. One of the children in our world, in our lifetime, who has done that is Cheyenne Webb. You've recently learned more about her story. She became a civil rights activist starting at the age of 8, even against her parents' own wishes. I learned about her story through the work of today's podcast guest, and I hope to the parents listening, today's conversation is a reminder of how children can help us see the world in a new way and become really activated to change the world for the better on behalf of our children and our children's children. Hey, Mama, welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy. I'm a co-founder here at Motherly. I'm also a mom of 5 myself. Today's guest is Catherine Russell Brown. Catherine is a legal scholar, criminal justice expert, and professor at the University of Florida College of Law, and she is also the award-winning author of 5 children's books. In our conversation, Catherine talks about what led her to start writing children's books and the importance of introducing our elementary age students to topics like race and criminal justice. And then we dive into the incredible stories inside her new book, Justice Rising, 12 Amazing Black Women in the Civil Rights Movement, and what she hopes that kids take away from her work.
Professor Catherine Russell Brown, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm really excited to talk with you.
We're so happy to have you. Okay, so I always like to start by asking my guests about their motherhood journey. And the way that I like to do that is this: what surprised you about motherhood?
How much work is involved, but mostly just the joy, just how much joy is attached. It's absolutely wonderful and it's absolutely completely terrifying and difficult, particularly when your little people are young. But what most surprised me was just my journey involved taking quite a bit of time to be able to have children as an older first-time mom, but also just the idea of raising twins. So that was a big surprise.
Oh my gosh. Twin mom life is such its own journey. When did you find out you're having twins?
We knew because there were infertility issues. So it was planned that we would hopefully have 2, if not hopefully have 1.
Did people prepare you, prep you? Did you have like a twin guru mom to help figure out? Because honestly, going from 0 to 2.
Well, one of the things I think is so fascinating is that there are some topics that people just want to give you advice on. And so motherhood is one of them. So people will, you know, tell you about their experiences and share their stories. So there was no lack of unsolicited advice around having kids.
Well, if a listener just found out she's about to have twins, do you have one piece of advice that you'd want her to know?
I mean, this is just motherhood advice. I get as much sleep as possible before the little people arrive. And, you know, trust your gut. It's a ride. It's a real ride trying to get two infants to get to sleep. But it goes by quickly. I can barely remember the sleep deprived first 2 years.
Oh, well, that's good advice for all moms, as you said. Get as much sleep as you can. So I'm also curious about what your own upbringing was like, and specifically how it may have led to your career as a lawyer with this expertise that you have in studying race and crime and as an advocate. So tell us how you got here.
Ooh, okay. So in college, I was a legal studies major, so I'd already had some interest in law, but I didn't go to college to study law. I initially thought I was going to be a psychologist, and then I wanted to be a journalist. And then on a lark, I took a course with one of my best friends who said, come on, let's take this course together. And it was a legal studies class. And I really, really enjoyed it. And so that's how I got to law school after being a legal studies major. But after I had done some law work, I was offered an opportunity to teach in the criminal justice program at Alabama State University, which is an HBCU in the capital in Montgomery. And that's how I really kind of got my foothold into criminal justice issues. And then I went back to school again for a PhD in criminology.
What made you fall in love with this area? And what did you feel like you were able to uniquely bring to your career?
Well, I would say an interest in issues of race and crime, and I would say an interest in addressing kind of policy or raising and attempting to address policy issues around racial equity, racial disproportionality.
I'm wondering if and how what you did at work, what you taught others, like how it shaped and influenced your own mothering and raising your kids and what you taught them and what you prioritized for them.
You know, absolutely. So I was teaching college, teaching grad students, teaching adults, and I was constantly being told by students that they had never heard of some of the things we were talking about. And talking about the criminal justice system, there's a lot of issues, you know, with regard to punishment, with regard to policing. And so I would always hear from students, and I thought, well, this is so interesting that, you know, here these are young adults, mostly people in their 20s, and they had never heard of some of the things that we were talking about or some of the histories that we were discussing in class. And I thought, I wonder if some of these issues could be presented to younger audiences. And so in thinking about that, that's kind of partly what sort of helped start the path for me to write children's books, is that I wanted young people to be exposed to more of these issues at a younger age.
How was it that your students had gotten that far in the American school system and weren't having any exposure to these topics?
When you think about it, it's not surprising. And I always say that teachers teach what they learned, right? So if some of these topics are not discussed in graduate schools of education, then we can't reasonably expect that teachers will talk about them when they get in the classroom. So that's how, right, is that people aren't exposed to material and, you know, really aren't familiar with it. And I'd like to say, I feel like I got kind of a separate PhD on issues of race in the criminal justice system, that it wasn't what I was taught in school, but I was interested. And so I had to kind of go out and go do some digging and reading and talking on my own.
How did you talk to your own children about these topics?
I mean, just time-wise, been through a lot. I kind of follow the advice that, you know, you often hear as a parent, and that is to answer the questions that you're asked by your children. And then you try, of course, to share with them what you want them to know. But yeah, I mean, we talk about contemporary issues. We talk about what's in the news. And so I just kind of go with where they take the conversation. And a lot of times, mothering, the guidance is in showing them how to listen, showing them that you are listening. And so for me, that's kind of encapsulated in thinking about critical listening.
You mentioned critical listening. Tell me what you mean by that and how you think other moms could help develop those really important skills in their own kids.
So I had my kids, I was over 40. And so I think part of just having them was like, now I have these young people who I can share all of my life experience with and tell them all the things they should do, shouldn't do, can do this way. And so not every encounter is about guidance and direction, but it's in the shared space and opportunity to talk and just kind of hang out. I'm not trying to figure out what I'm going to say after they're done. I'm listening and I'm going with that.
So when did you evolve your career or add to your career as a professor and realize that there was an opportunity in various forms of educating, whether it's the programs you've developed for elementary school curriculums or the books that you've written?
It's interesting because what I found as a mother of young children and looking at books, spending a lot of time in the library and in bookstores, was that there's so many books available, so many things, so many topics. But at that time, I'd say you were more likely to find a book with cows and horses and dogs and fish than you were books with children of color. And so that seemed really interesting to me and concerning. And so part of what I wanted to do was to add to what was available for young people to read. So if they can learn about animals, we can certainly learn about people of varying backgrounds. So I really just wanted to get something up there, have more, because I know when I was coming up, there were not that many books with children of color. My mother found what she could, and I'd say in particular, Black children. We loved Ezra Jack. So they just really, there were not a lot.
When your child has severe food allergies, you know you can't protect them every moment of their life. And the last thing you want is for them to miss out on life. So you stress allergen avoidance. You make sure everyone knows the action plan. And as they go and grow, you hope your child carries your voice in their head. But just in case, make sure they carry AviQ's voice with them too. AviQ is the first and only voice-guided epinephrine auto-injector. Learn more at avi-q.com/motherly. That's AUVI-Q.com/motherly. After using AviQ epinephrine injection USP, seek emergency medical care. Visit aviq.com/motherly for full prescribing and patient information.
I know you won a fellowship in 2009 on this project to integrate criminal justice issues into the elementary school curriculums. Can you talk a bit about that project in particular?
Sure. It was called Just Children. And I was interested there in kind of threading the needle between issues of criminal justice and young people. So I had an idea to write this story about a girl whose mother was returning home from prison. How she was anticipating her mother's return. She hadn't seen her mother in a year's time. So I wrote this story and I tried to get publishers interested in this story. No takers. And what I was getting back was, well, it's grim. It's sad. Her mother's not there. She's being raised by family members. You know, this won't land well for a young audience. And I'm thinking to myself, well, there's a few million children who have a parent who's behind bars. So this is actually a real story. And this real story should be told. And there have been other people, Jacqueline Woodson, for instance, had a book visiting day. So there were some books out there, but there was a kind of a general reluctance to take this on. And so I wanted to tell these stories.
Do you feel like the publishing world has shifted recently and things are changing, or do you feel like we're still not there?
I think there's always room for improvement. I think there's definitely been a lot more that's been published that shows a wide array of backgrounds in terms of the main characters in books. So I definitely think there's been improvement since we're talking about 15 years ago or so. But yeah, I think that the stories, children's life stories, are big. They're as big as stories for adults. I mean, big and grand in the sense of, you know, almost any topic. So I think there's a lot more writing of children's books to be done.
Absolutely. I love the cover. I love the back. This beautiful image of 12 amazing Black women shoulder to shoulder. It really sets the tone and shows the faces of these real women in the civil rights movement. Tell us why this book is so important to you.
The book is important because I think it does a few different things. It shows that women had a seminal part in the fight for civil rights. It shows that it wasn't just women, but it was women working together. So it wasn't just an individual or a single person to point to, that this was a group effort. It also shows women at various points. So some were born in the early 1900s, some born much later in the last century. But it also shows there are a few instances in which there are girls who were involved. So some people may not be familiar with Claudette Colvin, who was a 15-year-old girl who was leaving school, taking a bus. And this was in March of 1955. And this was 9 months before Rosa Parks decided not to move on the bus. But Claudette Colvin decided she was not going to move as she had been directed to by the bus driver. And so telling her story, I think, shows us that there's a kind of a continuum of people, and in this instance, women who were pushing back against the discriminatory laws. So I wanted to tell this story involving women and move it from the backstage to the front stage.
I love that so much. So much. And, you know, I think a lot about storytelling in our culture and whose stories get told, whose stories get centered. I know as a girl, I felt like it was always the men who were the heroes of these stories. And we're finally getting to an era where people like you are taking the time and making the effort. And there's so much that goes into getting a book published for years before any of your work comes out. So it's exciting. And also, I feel grateful for people, women like you, who are doing that work to bring these stories forward, because it seems to me that so many of these incredible girls and young women and grown women who did amazing things, their stories are not often centered. Their names are often not known. Why is that?
In part because, again, we teach what we were taught. We say the names we've already heard. And so it takes some digging, right? It takes some looking behind and underneath. And so that takes work. And so I feel fortunate that that's something that's exciting to me to do, is to do research. That's my wheelhouse. And so the stories that I tell are typically stories about actual people. So for me, this is what I'm interested in. But yeah, it takes more work, right? And there's so much to learn. But yeah, talking about these women was really exciting, just to learn more about their backgrounds. And this is just these 12 women. There's scores more women whose story should be front and center, who contributed to change.
Absolutely. So tell us, maybe pick one of the women in the book that you profile and tell our listeners a story that they may not have heard before about these incredible civil rights leaders.
So there are some of the women readers who are more likely to have heard about. So Coretta Scott King, for example, who many will know was Martin Luther King Jr.'s wife, but she had her own kind of story and involvement with civil rights on her own. But, you know, people have heard of Rosa Parks. But I like the story of Cheyenne Webb. I mean, there's so many great stories in here because she's a young girl. She was 7 years old, and she became known as the smallest freedom fighter, as she was named by Martin Luther King. But what I like about her story is that she was just walking to school one day, and she was walking past a church, and she noticed that out in front of the church, there were Black people and white people talking to one another. And this was like a sight to her. She'd never seen this before. So she really just wondered what was going on. So she kind of slipped into the church in the back and sat and listened. So she's missing school, and she's there for hours, and she's listening to people at this church meeting talk about voting rights for Black people. And she was so enthralled. As I said, she was there for hours. She missed school. She goes home. She talks to her mother about this, and she becomes very interested in learning more about civil rights and about what she can do. And she went to the Selma to Montgomery March, and there was a lot of tumult and upheaval as protesters were attacked by police. But just her interest, I think, is an inspiring story. And she's still alive.
Have you spoken to any of the women in the book that you profiled?
You know, I haven't, but almost half of them are still with us. Ruby Bridges, Claudette Colvin, who I mentioned earlier, Diane Nash, Senior Bernice Johnson Reagan, and then Cheyenne Webb, who we just talked about.
You know, you mentioned in the book that Dr. King called Cheyenne the smallest freedom fighter.
Yes.
And I'm thinking about that because our listeners are raising children, and I wonder what you'd want them to know about the power that kids have to change the world, and how we might think about talking to, educating, empowering, shaping our kids through the injustice that they see around them today.
Yeah, and I think children are our, you know, in some ways, they tell us what's really going on in the world, right? They're seeing very clearly what they see. They're not trying to sugarcoat it or make it something different than what it is. And so I think they're truth tellers. And so to me, it's through Cheyenne Webb, through some of the children in these stories, I think they kind of add that sheen to reality. They're giving you what you see. And so I like these stories of these young people. I mean, with Claudette Colvin, she's sitting on the bus. She said she can feel the weight of her ancestors that are kind of keeping her in her seat and stopping her from getting up as she's being directed and yelled at and told to get off the bus and to move. But this idea that she had been in class, she had been in school, and her teacher was teaching about civil rights. And she said, I knew I had rights, right? So her rights to her weren't tempered by, oh, I'm afraid, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. But to her, she was exercising her right to sit where she wanted to sit on the bus. So I think for young people, if we listen, they're telling us, they're sharing with us what they see and what we need to do.
That's really true. And I can think of some examples where there were things that I was overlooking that my kids were so clearly like, Mom, we need to do something about that. And they have a lot to teach us too. I love that you include the stories of those girls and young women in your book. I'm curious if there were any women who you profiled that you were less familiar with, or things you uncovered in your research that you didn't know before.
Oh, absolutely. I had heard about some of these women that the women in the story that I end up telling stories about, but I had no idea some of the backstories involving these women. I'd heard about Fannie Lou Hamer and her quote that she often used. She said she was tired of being sick and tired, and she'd been in the Mississippi Delta working for rights. But, you know, some of these women really had a lot they were bringing to the fight for civil rights. Hamer herself didn't even get really involved in the civil rights movement until she was 44 years old. That's when she learned that Black people had voting rights at 44. So it's never too early. It's never too late. And as many of the women were profiled, they were required to do a lot of work, a lot of manual labor. Hamer herself had a polio when she was a young child. She was one of 20 children in her family. These were her working women who, when they got a glimpse just from Fannie Lou Hamer at 44 to all the way down to Cheyenne Webb at age 7, once they found out what their rights were, what was going on, they jumped right in.
I'm curious how reflecting on and even curating the essence of their stories and what inspired them to be so courageous. What about that speaks to you and inspires you in your work today?
It's a good question. When you think about what many of these women and young women were putting on the line, some of them were jumping in and didn't know what the outcome would be, but they were being guided by what they thought was the right thing to do at the right time. And so pretty incredible when you think about what kinds of repercussions they might face. Many of them were faced with physical harm, attending marches, trying to register people to vote. So it's pretty incredible when people kind of step up and step out and try to make things better for all of us.
You know, our listeners are mothers. This is the Motherly Podcast. And when I was reading the book and thinking about it and sharing it with my kids, it reminded me about how motherhood can be this empathy generator, right? Like I suddenly can imagine what it's like for other people. I don't know, but I can imagine that feeling of an injustice being done to your child or wanting the best for another person's child in a way that I think is an opportunity for harder work, you know, and deeper conversations about where we still have to go in terms of civil rights and equality in this country. I think we just have a language of the heart as moms and wanting the best for our kids and knowing what that means to other mothers as well. So there is still so much work to do. What would you want our listeners to contemplate, to work for, to be inspired and motivated by in wanting the best for all kids, as each mother does?
Yeah, I think the stories, the life stories are broad ones. I think that we want to expose our children to a range of realities, a range of stories of history. So that's what I would focus on, is having a big picture. And that's what I try to do with my children, you know, and you want them to, in that way, kind of get ready for the real world. The world is big and vast and different and crazy. So that's what I would want.
I agree. And these books are a way to do them, right? For all kids to be exposed to stories that they may not have heard before. And the fact that they're such inspiring women and profiles in an era that so many of us have learned about, but stories and experiences, like what it's like to be arrested as Diane Nash was when she was pregnant, just these components of this history that we didn't know. It really happened. We just didn't, we haven't been taught.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because again, at great risk, right? So you're thinking, well, when I was pregnant, that's the last thing. That's what makes it so incredible that, you know, these women were willing to risk reprimand from family members, reprimand from work, and then again, placing themselves maybe in physical danger, because she was arrested and she spent time behind bars as a result of being arrested.
So, Catherine, at Motherly, we believe that motherhood brings out our superpowers. And I like to caveat that by saying that I don't think mothers are superhuman, and I don't think they should always have to bear superhuman burdens. But I mean that in the sense that motherhood can strengthen us, bring out talents, skills, things that we didn't even know were inside of us before we became moms. So that's what I mean. And I'm curious, what do you see as your superpower?
So I like that caveat. So I don't think I have a power as a mom that I can turn on and make everything better. So I agree with you. And I think superpower as, I guess, kind of like an unexpected gift. And so to me, mothering is intentional. right? And so one of those intentionalities for me is critical listening and hearing what my children are saying to me and not what I want to hear. Scientists have said that, you know, if you do some task or some activity for 10,000 hours, that's what's required to become an expert. So I think, you know, after mothering, right, for hours and hours and thousands of hours, you do become expert at hearing your children, figuring out what the next best steps are, being flexible, realizing that they are not you. That was a big lesson for me. My children are not me as young people. They are themselves.
I love that. I need to work on that.
Me too. Me too.
And as your twins are now 18 and on their journey to adulthood, I wonder how motherhood has shifted or evolved or even a mantra or mindset you're bringing into this next phase of motherhood.
So my children were going to the next step, we're going to college. And for years, I've been hearing about the emptiness. And I don't know, it didn't seem like a real thing, but it is a real thing. But I'm trying to look at it as, you know, they're ready to fly, right? We brought them to a place where they are ready to travel out. It's the next natural step. And I don't know why I was surprised about it, because my mother was not excited when I decided to leave home, and it was after college. So, you know, I think it's the next step of the journey. And I think we have to embrace it all.
So her, I know it happened so quickly. My oldest is 11 and I can't understand how we got here so quickly already. Oh, it's a good reminder. But also that motherhood keeps going on. You know, it's not done when they're 18. It's
right. No. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. Dr. Catherine Russell Brown, thank you for joining us on the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for our episode. Thank you so much, Catherine. And thanks to our listeners for tuning into our podcast. We'll be back next week with another great guest. You don't want to miss it. As always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast. So if you can right now, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Leaving a review takes no more than 30 seconds, but it really helps other people discover our show. And I read all of your feedback. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett with audio editing from Joel Edinburgh. Our associate producer is Olivia Hendrickson. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.